Hey folks, it's Harry from Slap Your Daddy Barbecue. I have some exciting news for you. You guys definitely have to tune in to the great guys, Jeff, and special guests, Doug and Leonard, on Baseball and Barbecue Podcast coming to you soon.
From the studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York, this is episode number 183 of the Baseball and BBQ podcast, where the BBQ stands for
Meathead and Doug Scheiding.
I don't know what BBQ is in that, but okay. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, and you are Leonard Hollywood Aberman. Welcome back to our podcast, BBQ, Meathead, Doug Scheiding. I don't think there's a B or a Q in that.
You would be right, Jeff. First of all, I am so glad to be with you on episode 183. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah.
And the BBQ, if you don't know, it stands for barbecue by now. It stands for everything about barbecue, and our guests are Meathead and Doug Scheiding. Boy, the way Glenn Miller played. Songs that made the hit parade. Guys like me, we had it made. Those were the days. We've got Meathead and Doug Scheiding. And for people that don't know, as Jeff rubs it, I must sing, Jeff. I have to sing. We have Larry Berra, son of the great. The great Yankee, the World Series champion Yankee, one of, if not the greatest catcher that ever played the game, Yogi Berra. We have an exciting show with all three of them. But before we get to that, I want to tell everyone that betonline.ag is your number one source for all your basketball information, stats, news, and scores. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest player reports for this year's pro basketball playoffs. BetOnline is always your sports information headquarters this season, as we have you covered for all your sports wagering needs. Basketball, Major League Baseball, the NHL, hockey, right to UFC and boxing. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to get your betting information, including live betting options and your favorite casino and card games you can play right from your home. So head to the website today. You can use your mobile device to get in on the action. Be sure to use our promo code BLEAV. That's BLEAV to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, where the game starts. Jeff, would you say this is a Hall of Fame episode?
Well, we have a son of a Hall of Famer, that's for sure. And we do have a Hall of Famer, a barbecue Hall of Famer.
Exactly.
That's for sure. And a future barbecue Hall of Famer.
Exactly. This is a Hall of Fame episode. And I don't want to delay anymore. But I will say that you guys stay tuned, because in between episodes, we've got a little special surprise for you. Courtesy of Jeff. He may not like my singing, but I like what's coming up. It's Meathead and Doug Scheiding. And you know what, Jeff? What I love about the interview with Meathead and Doug, you can listen to Meathead on plenty of podcasts, but he talks about things differently on ours because it's baseball and barbecue. There's a lot of sport talk, and I think everyone's going to really enjoy it. Meathead and Doug Scheiding. Baseball and barbecue fans, sometimes we come out with an episode that even I'm impressed with. This is going to be one of them. We have with us two of the foremost authorities on baseball. That's right, baseball. I think they know a little bit something about barbecue too, but we'll find out. We have Meathead, who joined us way back, way too long. And Meathead, of course, is from AmazingRibs.com. It's a fantastic website. It's the most viewed, most downloaded, whatever you do with it, website on the internet for barbecue. There's a Pitmaster Club with 16,000 members, of which I am proud to be one. And absolutely, it is. I highly recommend it. You can go on that website and you never need to go anywhere else. It is unbelievable. As a matter of fact, Meathead's pastrami will be on my table.
In a couple of weeks.
One
of the best things I've ever cooked.
Yeah. So we could talk all about that. But also, Meathead is the author of an incredible book. And of course, I've got it right here. Actually.
Oh, there it is.
But it is Meathead.
Dougie's holding it up.
The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Over 250,000 copies sold. Hopefully there will be more. He's coming out with another book. I mean, just unbelievable. Meathead, we're so happy to have you with us on Baseball and Barbecue. And of course, we have Doug, our family member, Scheiding. Doug, Rogue Cooker Scheiding. Guys, welcome to Baseball and Barbecue.
Well, that's the first time I've ever been called an author.
Thank you for joining us. Of course, Len took up so much time with the introduction that we have to finish now. So thank you very much. And
thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
It was great. See you.
No, that was good. So, well, as the co-host, I get to open, throw the first pitch, so to speak, Meathead. I've been warming up seriously a long time, but I'm going to ask you a question like the Barbecue Central show, 100% a surety pick, and you can expound upon it as you like. You have been pouring enormous hours into this book number two. So is book number three on the docket?
No.
Yes or no, 100%?
No.
Yes, no.
Absolutely no.
Okay.
If you hear me announce another book, you have permission to hunt me down and shoot me.
Well, you said that after the first book, but well, that, yeah, I'm just saying
that's before they've offered me a lot of money. If you've looked at what I write on AmazingRibs.com, if you look at the last book, you know I'm into details. I'm a perfectionist, and this book has to be different from the last book, has to have new content, and it's just been a massive effort and project. And not only that, I turned it in and I said, guys, there's enough here for two books. Can we do a two-book set? That's never been done. And they said, no, one book. So now I'm trying to cut it in half. So maybe there would be a third book. No, it'll all just go on the website, whatever doesn't make the cut. But it's a good book. I'm proud of it. It won't be out till about a year from now.
Meathead, you are from actually our area. You know, Jeff opens up all the shows. He says, from the studios of Long Island, New York. And you are very familiar with Long Island, New York.
I was born actually in Chicago, but very soon after birth, my folks moved me to Levittown on Long Island, which was a new concept of a suburb. And we lived there for a number of years. And then we moved to East Meadow, also on Long Island. And Dad had a about an 18-foot runabout boat, and we used to go out off of Montauk Point, catch bluefish, and fond memories. I lived there till I was about 10 years old. Then we moved to Florida, where I lived in Sarasota, close enough to the summer training, the spring training of the Chicago White Sox. And so I became a White Sox fan long before I moved back to Chicago.
But you were a Yankee fan, right, originally?
Oh, gosh. I was a fanatic Yankee fan. I mean, I was born in 49. So 61, I was 11 years old in school. And I had a little pink transistor radio with a little earbud. And they were no bigger than today's earbuds. They just had a cord. And I put that thing in my desk. And I had one of those desks that flopped open, run the cord up under my shirt, plug the earplug in and turn my head so the teacher couldn't see it. And we'd listen to the games because there was this astounding home run race going on between Roger Maris and Yankee Mickey Mantle. And I was a Mantle fan for years before Maris arrived. And it was just thrilling. It was exciting. And that's all the boys would talk about it during recess and right on up through the World Series. So, yeah, I was a Long Island boy, Long Island, and a Yankee fan for much of my youth.
You know what goes with baseball is hot dogs. I know Doug isn't a fan, but Meathead, I know you sent us an article on hot dogs, the country's best regional hot dogs, and you have Nathan's on here, which is in Brooklyn. And so I want to know, do you prefer Nathan's or do you prefer Sabrette's, or what's your favorite hot dog?
Well, all right. Hot dogs are really interesting. They're a sausage. And so they were typically made by local sausage makers. So they really varied around the country, the blend, the technique. But what was more interesting, you know, you in one city mile, you can go out and get 20 different styles of hamburger. But there is a distinctive Chicago style hot dog. There is a distinctive Cincinnati style hot dog. There is a distinctive Coney Island dog. There's a distinctive Rhode Island hot wiener, Connecticut Texas wiener, the New Jersey Italian dog, the Rochester garbage plate. And these were all distinctive styles. And you know, for example, here in Chicago, it's verboten to put ketchup on a hot dog. And you know, you go into a hot dog restaurant and order a hot dog and get your fries. And if you want ketchup, they'll say, not on the hot dog. And you say, no, it's for the fries. All right, it's over there. And there's a pump over there. And he says, put it on the hot dog, ruin it yourself. We won't do it for you. and the ingredients in a Chicago hot dog, there's 7 precise ingredients. And you don't vary from it. And there's hundreds of hot dog joints all over Chicago, and they all make them exactly the same. And the same thing with the Cincinnati Coney's, the Detroit Coney. The Detroit Coney is a fascinating one. It's got a chili on top, but the chili is often made from beef heart. You don't see that everywhere. There's, of course, corn dogs. And there's a fascinating battle over who invented the corn dog around the country. The Sonoran hot dog, which is something of a strange animal out of Arizona, the Seattle cream cheese dog. I mean, they're just, you know, and they're really distinctly, you know, and then, of course, Dodger dogs. Now we're talking baseball.
Sure.
And they're all distinctly different and regional.
Seattle cream cheese dog?
Yeah, yeah. They actually put cream cheese on a dog, especially from the street carts. Cream cheese, and it varies slightly. Sometimes they're griddled, sometimes they're simmered. Usually they've got griddled onions, and then they put a smear of cream cheese on one side of the bun and some Dijon-style mustard on the other side. Hot dog goes in the middle, and then it's crowned with caramelized onions and sauerkraut. Now, it varies. They're not as rigid in their style as other locations like Chicago. But some places like that put sriracha, barbecue sauce, pickled jalapenos. But yeah, cream cheese on a hot dog in Seattle, especially the street vendors. I heard them intimate that you don't like hot dogs.
I do not. I have gone. I'm known for a rant that I had for about 2 minutes on my hatred of hot dogs and how the only appropriate time to eat a hot dog is at a baseball game. Other than that, it's mystery meat and it's a lot of condiments and stuff. So it sounds like that's the major change. But
the condiments between are part the different of the story. Dogs. The Chicago dog is known as drag it through the garden. And it evolved out of the Depression in Maxwell Street, which was after the Chicago fire. Maxwell Street area actually survived. That became a merchant area, and there was a lot of fresh produce and lumber and stuff for rebuilding. But the hot dog, and Flukie's was the one I think that started it, drag it through the garden, because the working man needed a meal. So he got meat and vegetables all on a bun. And that's why it's got a pickle spear, lettuce, tomato, celery seed, celery salt, and a mustard. And it's you know, they call it dragon through the garden. And Doug, I'm really shocked to hear you say this. And I don't think we can be friends anymore.
Oh, no. All right. Well, you will definitely cut me out of the Christmas card list. I will send you a video, the animations that that Greg has done, et cetera. I've actually animated my rant and I will send it to you. So, I need to post that.
I
want to
see that
on my socials.
I love hot dogs.
Oh, and yeah.
I will often eat them in airports.
Okay. Well, let me ask a question related to something we can agree on. Hopefully your background in wine. I'm not sure a lot of people know about your background in wine. Oh, there you go. So my love of wine, et cetera. So I think wine and barbecue have some similarities, et cetera. So if you wouldn't mind, give a little bit of background on your wine career prior to starting Amazing Ribs.
Well, I was a wino. I mean, you know what the difference between a wino and a connoisseur is, don't you?
Yeah.
$10 a bottle. I went to college in Gainesville, Florida, the University of Florida. I was a Gator. And that's a good story. It reminded me to tell you about how the time I played for the Gators during spring practice. But I got a job at ABC Liquors. ABC was a chain in those days, 100-plus stores. I don't know how many they got now. And they had a big store in Gainesville on Newberry Road that I worked in. I remember one Easter, I was invited to the home of one of my fraternity brothers and his wife, and she was cooking a ham. And so I got out the Hugh Johnson Encyclopedia of Wine, which was a definitive guide, and found a wine called Chateau Carbonneau, a white Bordeaux, and it was $3.99 in those days. I remember, God almighty, that's expensive. Today, it's got to be $39.99 or more. And I bought a bottle of this, and we brought it to dinner. And poor Connie, she had worked all day making this fabulous meal, and all anybody could talk about was this wine, and none of us were winos. And it set me down a path, and I started buying wine and tasting wine and getting into it. And I worked later in a wine shop in Dearborn, Michigan. And I went to a Tigers game, which is a good story. And then I moved to Chicago and worked in a wine shop here in Chicago. Eventually got a job writing a weekly column about wine in the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, started a magazine about wine. I was on the U.S. wine tasting team. Became a hardcore wino and still drink wine with dinner every night. And there's a glass of Pinot Noir in my hand right now.
So I want to go back to hot dogs for a second.
Yes.
First of all, is a hot dog a sandwich?
Oh, yes. It's meat between two slices of bread. They're funny shaped slices. Yeah, there's this argument whether a hamburger is a sandwich or not. A sandwich is two slices of bread with something in between. I don't care the shape of the bread. Yeah, I have no problem calling it a hamburger, a sandwich.
By the way, before I forget, you guys know today is Jeff's birthday.
Oh my gosh, no way.
Yeah. So today is Jeff's birthday.
Yeah, but by the time they listen to this, it won't be.
But
you can celebrate it twice.
Yeah. So happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank you. Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm great too, pal.
So am I.
More hot dog questions. Do you prefer natural casings? There's natural casings and then there's skinless, right?
Yeah. And there's also cellulose casings. I like the snap. Right. It has to have a snap. And so, yes, natural casings, your hog casings usually. In my world, the best hot dogs are all beef. You mentioned earlier Nathan's. That's an all beef hot dog out of Nathan's in Long Island, an iconic hot dog. If you've never been to Nathan's, the mothership on Long Island, on Coney Island, you got to go. It's just wonderful. It's fun. They're cooked on a flat top griddle, and usually they've got the special New York onion mix, which I have reverse engineered, and the recipe for which is on AmazingRibs.com. If you're a displaced New Yorker or even an active New Yorker and you want to know how to make that onion stuff that goes on the hot dogs, I'll give you the recipe on AmazingRibs.com.
The other thing I wanted to mention to everyone, is Meathead was just recently on the Barbecue Central show, and he talked about chatbots. And I actually want to tell everybody, this is not Meathead. This is a chatbot.
No,
that was a fascinating.
What happened is the minute chatbot launched, I just out of curiosity looked at it, and I fell out of my chair. And I own a business. I'm a businessman in addition to being a barbecue guy. And as soon as I saw it, I said, holy cow, this is going to affect everything. This is going to change the internet. And wow, what is it going to do to the search engines? And I talked to my team and I said, guys, I think if Bing, which already has begun the process of integrating these chatbots into their search, and Google is not far behind with its Bard, we are going from the age of search to the age of ask. And so I had a friend who, Peter Parts out of upstate New York, who is involved with the alumni of the MBA program at Rochester Institute of Technology. And he invited me to come and speak to MBA graduates, alums at RIT via Zoom, and on the subject of how chatbots like ChatGPT are going to vastly change the internet. And if you don't know what they are, you better find out, especially if you run a website and your website is important for your revenue. Because the age of search is, we want to find something out. We go to Google, we type in a question, and it gives us a list of websites, and we can decide which one to go to try to get an answer and go to more than one. In the very near future, by this time next year, you're going to be able to ask Google a question, and it's going to give you a 500-word answer or more in plain English that you won't need to click any links. And that's going to vastly impact the business of many companies, including mine.
Along this topic, I went to ChatGPT originally, and I was put on a waiting list, to get in. That they kind of capped it at some particular level. I went back today in preparation for this, and I was going to do a few things on it. And they wanted me to join and then charge me a subscription fee of $7 a month.
That's new. I think there's still a free version.
Yeah.
And they're up to version 4 now, which is wrapped. The tech it's shifting under our feet right as we speak.
Yeah. So do you think the $7, I'm not paying $7 for
I don't
at least
think you one. Have to. I think you can get it for free if you.
Okay.
Doug, I know you have business interests that have connections to the internet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is the most earth-shaking, consequential. Now, I've been publishing on the internet since the early 1990s. I have seen it all. I was there before Google, when Yahoo was the dominant. I know an awful lot. This is the biggest change since the iPhone, and maybe bigger.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but if they start charging a monthly fee, I think that may inhibit it. But maybe there's so many that are going to be out there that there'll be some free ones. So I just wanted to see if you thought that would affect the thing. So
it does an awful lot. And even if you have to pay it for a couple of months, you should.
Yeah. So, okay.
There's a podcast with Alan Alda, from MASH.
Yes. And his old buddy from MASH.
James Farrell. It's called Clear and Vivid. And they actually had a chatbot that wrote a script for them, a scene for MASH, and they acted it out. So if you're a MASH fan, it's not that the scene was the best, but hearing Alan Alda and Farrell together again was great. But a chatbot wrote the scene for them.
What it can do is breathtaking.
Unbelievable. Meathead, you talked about being around before, Google, and your website, as I said in the intro, is fascinating, is terrific. I mean, amazingribs.com. Apologies to everyone else that we've ever had on, to every other website that's great. If there was only one website that I could be on, it would be yours.
God almighty.
How do you go from, obviously you didn't start out with this incredible website. Take us through a little bit about how do you start it and then just grow it into this mammoth?
Well, the history is I owned a company called Beverage Testing Institute, which was a pioneer in setting up procedures for judging wine. And those procedures are still out there and state of the art. We changed the way wine judgings and competitions are held. And I published a magazine called International Wine Review, which I sold. And eventually I sold the website. And in the year 2000, after I sold the website, I was just kind of figure out what to do with the rest of my life. And I was in a barbecue and had always been in a barbecue. I learned to grill from my dad when I was a kid. He used to go out back on his early Weber kettle and do flank steak was his specialty. And I'd sit there and, God, you know, the smell of beef grilling. And I, you know, an 11, 12 year old kid. And he might have let me have a sip of beer along the way, you know, which kind of got me juiced up. And so I just decided, you know, after I had spent 18 years in the wine world, it was time to switch to solid food. So I got my recipe for amazing ribs and published it on a website. And it just started growing and growing. And we were what they call a first mover. There were no barbecue related websites in 2005. And Google liked us. And if you get Google to like you, you have a business. And it grew, and now there's over 2,000 pages of free content available on AmazingRibs.com, including technology, techniques, method. We review products. We're very careful about our review processes, grills, smokers, thermometers, you name it. If you're shopping for a grill, you need to go there and see what Max Good said about it. Max is the world's only full-time grill tester. We don't have any sponsors. We don't take any outside money. We're not on anybody's payroll. Nobody tells us what to like and dislike. We're supported primarily by our members. They pay $34.95 a year to join our Pitmaster Club. And that not only supports us, but we give them back. There's a lot of cool stuff they get, including a half a dozen free ebooks and some magazines they get and a bunch of other stuff. So, you know, it enjoys several million page views a month and 16,000 plus members of the Pitmaster Club. And it's just a cool place. And there's some really good barbecue websites out there. And I'm a fan of them and I check them out, but none of them hold a candle to us.
That is absolutely true.
I'm flattered you think so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And can't let this go by. There's two stories that I'd like you to tell. Because you brought them up. First, you mentioned a Tigers game.
Ah,
please tell us that story.
Well, this was what year? 1970, 69, 70, 69 or 70, tail end of the Vietnam War. The nation was divided like it is now. We have a great political divide right now between right and left. But in those days, it was pro-war and anti-war. Vietnam was highly controversial. And there were the people who believed that we needed to fight this war to stop communism, and those of us who felt it was an immoral war. And all the hippies, that was me. I was a college hippie, long hair down to my shoulders. I smoked marijuana on a regular basis in those days. You know, my mother warned me it would lead to bigger stuff, and she was right. I smoke pork now.
And a little brisket.
And brisket. And I was living in the back of a Toyota pickup truck in the parking lot of the Dearborn Municipal Recreation Center. And I, you know, I would add a little Coleman stove and I cook my meals and I'd go to the country club and I would shower and shave every day. And I got a job in a wine shop nearby. One day I decided I wanted to go to a ball game. I love baseball. It was part of me. I got my way to the old Detroit Stadium. I forget the name of the old stadium. Does anybody remember?
Nevin Stadium, or it was Tiger Stadium.
Tiger Stadium, I remember.
Before that, it was Nevin Stadium.
I don't remember that name, but I went to old Tiger Stadium, and I was wandering around looking for the ticket booth and I couldn't find it. A cop sidled up to me and here I am. I'm wearing coveralls, hair down to my shoulders. And he said, "Can I help you, son?" And I said, "Well, I'm looking for the ticket booth." And he says, "You like baseball?" I said, "Yeah, I want to go to the game today." And he said, "Here, son, I got an extra ticket." And he gave me a free ticket. It was a box right behind the dugout on the third baseline. Some of the best seats in the house. I had a blast. I mean, Willie Horton. I don't remember all the players, but it was just tremendous fun. And, you know, it kind of gave the old hippie cops are all pigs a different perspective.
Nice, nice. Doug, go ahead.
Oh, yes, fine. One of my favorite things about your book, the Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, are the myths. What do you think are some of the biggest, you know, the myths that you've basically debunked, if you will? Yeah, are there some that kind of stick out for you that you still, you know, have to correct people on a, you know, daily, monthly basis?
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I learned to barbecue from my dad. And most of us, you know, it was handed down and they just gave us the tried and true methodology, the traditions, and that goes on today. What's happened over the past 20 years is science. And, you know, that we've learned an awful lot about food technology and food science. And, you know, some of the ones that are most obvious is that I hear this all the time, searing seals in the juices. It doesn't. The meat fibers are full of juice. There's juice in between. Searing is crucial because it creates flavor, but it doesn't do anything to sear in the juices. And if you sear a steak, you'll see the juices still come to the surface. It's easy to prove scientifically. It just doesn't work. It doesn't sear in the juices. I describe this myth in detail on AmazingRibs.com. I'm not going to get into it in detail right now. Another one is soaking wood chips. Every barbecue book, and I have two bookshelves full of them. I don't know if this broadcast is going to be video, but those are all barbecue books over there.
Lots of books.
And they all say, soak your wood chips. And if you soak the wood chips, you get more smoke. That's not true. Wood doesn't absorb water. That's why they build boats out of it. You can take wood chips, weigh them, soak them overnight, pat the surface dry, weigh them again, and they weigh about 3% more. And that 3% is just the water that's trapped in the fibers on the surface and the pores. And if you cut the wood chips open, there's no water inside. Wood doesn't absorb water. And most of the books say soak them for an hour or two, for crying out loud. What happens is when you throw wet wood chips on charcoal, it knocks the temperature down. And of course, you want to control temperature when you're cooking. So that's a bad issue. The other thing is you see all this white stuff coming out. Everybody says, wow, look at all the smoke I'm generating. It's not smoke. It's steam. Steam comes off at 212 degrees. Wood doesn't start smoking till 500 degrees. So it can't start smoking until the water is steamed off. So you throw wet wood chips on, the wood goes up to 212. And then it steams off and all that steam comes out. Then the water comes off, the temperature drops, and it slowly works its way back up to 500. Now it starts to smoke. So you haven't done anything to improve the smoke. If you throw wood on the fire, it will catch on fire. And that's the other one. People say, I don't want it to catch on fire. I want it to smoke. Well, smoldering wood creates a less flavorful smoke than burning wood. Burning wood, especially with yellow flame, is combusting contaminants, compounds in the wood that make the wood have bad flavor. So you want your wood to burn with yellow flame. So that, you know, that again, that is all in the book and on the website. That's another popular myth. And of course, the biggest one of all is I don't want to use a thermometer. I want to poke the meat with my finger.
The hand test.
And then, you know, if it feels like the the muscle between my thumb and forefinger, and if I clench my fist, and I mean, you know, I'm an overweight guy, and my fist is different than an athlete. That's absolutely absurd. A digital thermometer will tell you, A, if the food is safe. You do not want to serve poultry under 160 degrees. Almost all poultry has salmonella, and you've got to get it up there to make it safe. You don't want to send grandma to the hospital on Memorial Day. And a digital thermometer, and nowadays, you can buy a high-end one that'll give you a precision measurement within a second. Most of them within 5 seconds. That old dial thermometer in your kitchen drawer that you stick in the meat and it takes 30 seconds to give you a reading, and it's not accurate. Those bimetallic dials were designed in the 1800s. If you've got one of those, take it, put it in your driveway, and back your car over it. Get a good digital thermometer. And we've got an electrical engineer that tests and rates thermometers. Pick one of the ones he's given high marks to. We don't sell them. We'll send you to a link that does sell them. And get yourself a good instant read digital thermometer. A medium rare steak, 130 to 135 degrees, period. It doesn't matter what color it is when you cut into it, because the lighting affects the color. Oxygen affects the color. 130 to 135 degrees is medium rare. And that's when it is scientifically most tender and most juicy. And digital thermometer will get you there every time. You'll never have to stand at the head of the table and say to your guests, kind of gone away from me tonight. I'm awfully sorry. So there's three of them right there.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Jeff, what has a digital thermometer done for your cooking game?
Oh, it is. It brought up my game so much. I mean, it changed the way I cook.
Nothing Absolutely. Will improve your cooking faster.
Yes, exactly.
It's right. More important than sharp knives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the number one barbecue tool by far.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Man, I want to ask
I still run into people who say, well, I cut into it and I look at it. And, you know, or I poke it, and it's a guessing game, and there's no need to guess anymore.
Mina, why does Len still cook bear con chicken?
Dog, thank you.
Throwing me under the bus.
Yeah, beer can chicken is another one. And I get people, they all say, my beer can chicken is fantastic. Of course it's fantastic. It's roast chicken. All roast chicken is fantastic. But the beer can has nothing to do with it. The beer can, the beer, first of all, it's not really hot enough for a lot of it to evaporate. And if you weigh the can before and after, you may discover it's heavier after, because juices drip in and they're full of fat and they lay on top of the beer, which keeps the beer from evaporating. But the chicken itself is 75% water, fully saturated, and no liquid can get in. And even if it could, it's only at the very top of the beer can. So it's not getting all the way down to the thighs and the legs. All it's doing is keeping the cavity from browning. But it looks cool, and it's roast chicken, and it's still delicious.
And it's a waste of a good beer.
Well, now you're talking.
I thank you, Jeff, for doing that.
You're welcome.
He threw you under the bus, dude.
It's okay. It's okay. It's your birthday.
You can call me Bus from now on.
He'd had one more story that you mentioned it, and we have to hear it. The Gator story. Florida Gators.
Oh. Well, I was a journalism major at the University of Florida, which is one of the great journalism schools in the country. And I was the sports editor for the Florida Alligator, which is the campus newspaper. And I had played high school ball and loved it. And I really feared that I would never put on pads again. So I went to the head coach and I said, I'd like to write about the Gators. Can I come out for spring training and dress out and go through spring training with the team and write about it on a weekly basis? And he gave me the okay. And they gave me a locker right next to Jack Youngblood. Now, I don't know if anybody here knows that name.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In the College and Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yes.
And he was 6'7", defensive end. And I had been a high school linebacker, but they decided there's no way they were going to. I was 5'7", 160, 70 pounds. There's no way they were going to put me in at linebacker. So they made me a safety, although I was kind of slow. It was a mistake to put me there. But in any case, I practiced with the safeties. And when there was a defensive huddle, I'd stand next to Youngblood, and he'd rest his elbow on my helmet. and you know, I did my weekly columns in the Florida Alligator about how the Gators were doing this year. They had a good team, and it was fun. Come the orange and blue game, which was the spring game, the final game of the season, they let me dress in the in the dress uniform, and I sat on the bench with my helmet underneath me and a clipboard in my lap. And I'm taking notes and writing my final column as Paper Gator. This was all inspired by George Plimpton's Paper Tiger. George Plimpton was a sports writer. He was just a writer, but he was fond of sports. And he was one of these guys who threw himself into, and he tried out for the Detroit Lions. And he also tried out, he became a boxer, went into the ring with heavyweights. And he wrote these stories about how, you know, what it's like from the inside. So I was Paper Gator instead of Paper Lion. And the last play of the game, and I'm getting ready to head for the locker room. They blow the whistle, stop the game. Coach turns around and says, "Paper Gator, get in the game." Holy shit. I didn't even know where my helmet was. You know, I finally found my helmet. I ran out on the field. I there's a huddle there. And I start to go back to safety, and there's already two safeties. And the safety says, "No, you're middle linebacker." I said, "Wait a minute. I hadn't played middle linebacker all spring." And but they lined me up middle linebacker, and there I was, head up on the center, 3 yards from the center. And normally they played a 5-3, which meant there would be a nose guard head up on the center, and I would be behind him. There was no nose guard. They were in a 4-3, and I was the linebacker head up on the center. And as I looked up, the Gators were what they called the fun and gun, wide open backfield, passing like crazy. There were two backs in the backfield in an I formation. Never seen that. Fullback right behind the quarterback, halfback right behind the fullback. And it doesn't take long for me to figure out what's about to happen. I have a target on my chest. The ball is snapped. They're coming right at me. And I do the only thing I can to survive. I dive at the center's ankles, just face down, face plant right in the grass. And the center trips over me. The fullback trips over him, and the running back trips over the fullback. And the whistle blows. My record in the swamp is one play for a 1 yard loss. Match that, Alabama.
All right. Oh,
I love it. That. Thank you.
True story. I got pictures.
That's a great one. That's a great one.
Yeah.
Now, before we let Doug close it out, I just want to ask you one more. What will it take for you to go back to baseball?
You know my story. I quit baseball in 94 when they went on strike. I live in Chicago, which gave me the choice of two great ballparks, two average ball clubs, but they were fun to go to. My wife is a baseball fan. Her family's baseball fans. One of our brothers played college ball. And they lived about four blocks from Comiskey Park. So we went to baseball. And in 94, they went on strike. The rich owners and the players with their gold jewelry, they went on strike. And it wasn't bad enough they went on strike. But the strike lasted through the World Series, which means they stole the World Series. Now, Hitler could not stop the World Series. They played the World Series right through World War II. And now I just decided if these guys, if it means nothing to them, if the World Series means nothing to them, what should it mean to me? Nothing. And I haven't been back to a major league park, and I probably won't go back until they all die. And Jerry Reinsdorf, who owns the White Sox, is still alive and was alive then. And half of those players are gone, but my wife and I, we go to minor league games. We go to the King County Cougars and the Joliet Slammers. And there's a team called the Chicago Dogs. named after the Chicago hot dog. And it's not, it's a nice little park out by O'Hare. And we train puppies for Leader Dogs for the Blind as a hobby. And we take our puppy to the Chicago Dogs game. And he's beloved in the park. Their mascot is a mustard bottle. And the mustard bottle constantly beats up on the ketchup bottle. And it's just a fun place to go watch baseball. And you got to love these minor league players because they all have stars in their eyes. They all dream of making the bigs. They stick around and sign autographs until the last kid goes home. There's no gold jewelry. They're playing for the dream and for the love of the game. And I got to tell you, I much prefer it to, and I miss Wrigley, in particular Wrigley. The old Comiskey, they tore it down, and the new guaranteed rate film, the guaranteed rate stadium is nothing special. Wrigley is special. But, you know, it's just a lot of money, and it's it just doesn't appeal to me anymore.
But at least you're enjoying minor league baseball. It doesn't matter.
Minor league baseball could be fun. I mean, yeah, it's just that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, if your listeners are out there are addicted to major league ball, go see minor league game. And a lot of them, you know, the seats end at third base and first base. And you go and beyond third and first, you sit on the grass. And you just bring a blanket or some lawn chairs and you sit on the grass. And, you know, it's just a really comfortable environment. The concourses are wide open. You can wander around. They have lots of entertainment in between the innings and stuff. It's just, I think, kind of like baseball might have been in the 40s and 30s.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I also get to come in as Jeff Cohen's favorite closer. Position player, the closer. and he always advocates for more closers to be in the Hall of Fame, but that's a story for a different episode.
As Meathead, for those listening, Meathead is holding his glove and the ball, and he's wearing a baseball hat. You know, Meathead, it looks like you could be closing this out.
Ready for a catch. Ready for a catch. So, well, we're planning another trip. This question will be for my own personal edification, but I'm very interested in it. When I go on vacation down to Mexico and I sit at the pool, I'm the nerd with a highlighter and a pen and a book. That's how I read your first first book, is by the pool down in Cabo. So the only other book that I kind of consider in your same league as your first book is the Cook's Illustrated Meat Book. So that is one of my favorite books as well. Are there other books that are in your kind of same tier of that you feel that are, you know, reference guides or things that kind of meet the same altitude, if you will, of yours?
I have several favorite books, but I'm not in their tier. Harold McGee's book on food and cooking is a food science book. It's a thick textbook, but it is full of real science. And it's used in college classes, Harold McGee on food and cooking. And it's a definitive guide.
Nice.
And it answers every question you could have.
Okay.
I'm also fond of Michael Pollan's books, which are consumer-facing, consumer-oriented. Talk about our meat supply, our food supply, the role that corn plays and government subsidies. Fascinating book. My favorite cook is Kenji Lopez-Alt.
Yeah.
And he writes for Serious Eats and the New York Times. And he wrote the foreword to my book. And he's just a real geek. And he's written just recently a book called Wok. And I love Chinese food. And it's all about wok cooking. But his previous book, The Food Lab, is more general and covers everything that you can think of related to food. Anything Kenji writes. And he can be found in detail on SeriousEats.com. Great stuff. And he's always doing interesting experiments. Like how to get the crispiest chicken wings. And he does all this fun research and he gets the answers. And I'm reading a book now that is just blowing my mind Chloe Sorvino's, oh gosh, I don't remember the exact title, but it's got the word meat in it. She writes for the Wall Street Journal, and this okay. is expose on the meat industry and oh. how they are forming monopolies, how they're stealing from us.
Is it raw deal? Is that it?
Raw deal. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Meat is not in the title. I appreciate it. It is just, I've slapped my forehead until it's black and blue reading this thing. It has no recipes or anything in it, but it just is absolutely fascinating about where our food comes from. And gosh, I know I'm forgetting important ones. I've got these massive, there's just so many good cookbooks out there. Of course, Stephen Reichlin's Barbecue Bible,
yes.
I think is the only yeah. one that outsells my book. It's been out for 15 years, whatever. It's sold a million or more. He's anything he writes is worth reading.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much. So yeah, I will again.
I'll think of 20 more the minute we hang up, but you and I talk.
That's fine. You can send me an email, but I appreciate it if I can't find them. So thank you for answering that.
And you can find Meathead on Twitter. He's at Meathead. And he is not Rob Reiner, so don't send him any that opinion.
I get a lot of his. Oh God, yeah, he's very liberal and speaks loudly about politics, and people just are constantly attacking at Meathead. It's not me. Leave me alone.
And obviously, check out AmazingRibs.com. Thank you, Meathead, for joining us.
Thank you very what much, fun. Meathead.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you giving me time to dive into stuff and to talk. I get interviewed often for like 5-minute segments, and I hate that.
Oh no, wait! You have an open invitation.
Anytime.
Please, anytime. Yeah. Excellent.
You want to talk about Sonora dogs? I'm here.
Nice.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast, and if you want a lip-smacking, finger-licking good podcast, then you gotta listen to Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. They have the best guests and the best recipes on all the internet. So check it out, Baseball and BBQ.
And thank you, Meathead. Thank you, Doug. That was, as usual, a terrific, terrific interview, terrific segment.
Lots of information there. Boy, do I want a hot dog right now. I really do. But you know what, Jeff? I'll settle for something else.
What's that?
I'll settle for a baseball rant.
So I belong to this Facebook group. I'm not going to name the name because I don't want to give it out there. But I wrote a post, and it got, let's say, different opinions. I said it was due to Sunday Night Baseball where the Mets played the Giants. And I wrote, still don't understand why ESPN can't interview Nimmo, Brandon Nimmo, while he's in the dugout. It's intrusive to talk to him while he's on the field. And this, the vitriol that was coming at me, like, I can't believe it. If the players don't want to do it, they say no. He was happy to do it. I usually hate the interview. This one I actually enjoyed. Nimmo makes everything enjoyable. I love the mic'd up stuff. I think players should do more and more about it. This is an awesome interview. Best I've ever seen. He was great. He was articulate. I get that. I get Nimmo. Look, Nimmo's one of my favorite players on the Mets. He plays hard all the time. But do they really need to mic him up and put an earpiece in his ear while he's playing on the field? They can't interview him while he's in the dugout. You know, I got to tell you, that next inning, there was a fly ball to right field, and Michael Conforto, he didn't catch it. It went off his glove for an error. Could you imagine if that happened if he's mic'd up and with an earpiece in his ear? Then all these people would be going, wait a second, there's no way he should be mic'd up and have an earpiece in his ear. You know, it's ridiculous. Why does ESPN have to do that in on field interview? Do it in the All-Star game. Do it in preseason. Do you really have to bother them at work? I mean, how would you like someone talking to you and you're working? You know, it's not it's ridiculous. I know ESPN and all the gimmicks they have to do, but this does not add any value. You know, one of the questions they ask, who would you want to play you in a movie about your life? Really? Really? That's what we have to come down to? That's what we need to hear on ESPN? Do we really need to hear that? And, you know, if there's one error, you know that that will be the story. Whether it caused the error or not, just because there's an earpiece and a microphone, you know, if he committed an error, that would be the story. I don't care if they're okay to do it. They just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. For example, ESPN was showing a replay of a great catch the other day. Did they show the replay? Yeah, but then they also showed a logo of an ad on top of it. Then you couldn't see the replay. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. So just because they can mic someone up doesn't mean they should. You know, if they want to mic someone up, you know, and don't interview them, you know, like at first base, they have a microphone on the first baseman, and that's fine, cool, whatever. But don't interview them on the field. You have plenty of chances to interview them in the dugout. I don't know why ESPN does this, but that's my rant.
I would like to add to your rant, or I could sing another verse of the All in the Family
theme
song.
Add to the rant.
I agree with you as far as when they are on the field, they should be focused on the game, and they shouldn't be thinking about any kind of interview. I'm fine within the dugout. The on-the-field stuff is too much. I did not realize. I saw an article. I don't know why I didn't know this. I saw an article online that said that the players actually get paid to do those interviews. Did you know that?
I did not know that. But I think Nimmo's getting like $25, $26 million a year.
Yeah.
I don't really think he needs the extra shekels.
No. And right. I saw something. It said that they got like $10,000 to
that
do.
That seems excessive.
It does seem excessive. I know. And I saw it online. And I agree with you. It's some deal with the, you know, ESPN and all that. But whatever it is, you're right. I mean, what are they going to pay? You know, it's ridiculous. You're right. He's got plenty of money. But do it in the dugout. I totally agree with you. That's
I mean, just one error. I mean, Conforto just dropped the ball the next inning. If he was mic'd up and had an earpiece, you know people would be blaming that. It's a story. It's just a distraction. Does not need to happen.
And Jeff, that rant is brought to you by baseballbbq.com.
Right.
For their grilling tools and accessories. Because Jeff is hot like a fire, and fire is what you'll have at your next cookout. And what do you need at your next cookout? You need tools. By baseballbbq.com, because those tools have baseball bat handles and they are quite incredible. All right.
And if you agree with me, and if you don't agree with me, you can give us a call, 516-855-8214. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. You can even comment on Twitter.
Tweet, tweet.
At Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. We have a website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please rate, review, subscribe, follow, tell your friends, all that good stuff.
Jeff, can I get a shout out?
Shout out!
Let's give a shout out to our friends, Rich Baxter and Gary Mack of the Baseball Talk Radio Show. They deserve a shout out. They've been doing some great work. Once you listen to this podcast and you want to listen to something else, I don't know why you would, but I recommend you go to the Baseball Talk Radio Show. They really do a terrific job. So shout out to them. Before we get to Larry Berra, it needs no introduction, of course.
It's time for the Baseball Quote of the Week.
I never blame myself when I'm not hitting. I just blame the bat. And if it keeps up, I change bats. After all, if I know it isn't my fault and I'm not hitting, how am I going to get mad at myself? The great Yogi Berra.
Yes. And speaking of the great Yogi Berra, our interview with Larry Berra is very special. We spent the day at the Yogi Berra Museum in Montclair, New Jersey. And although it needs no special introduction, just to tell everybody that if you are anywhere in the vicinity, and I mean 2-3 hours away, to me, it's worth the trip, the Yogi Berra Museum. It was just a great experience.
And now, let's get to his son, Larry Berra.
Baseball and barbecue listeners, we have had such an enjoyable experience at the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Montclair, New Jersey. We are with Larry Berra, who has been extremely gracious. We are now sitting down with Larry, and what you guys are going to hear is going to blow you away. That's all I'm going to say.
Incredible.
Right, Jeff?
Incredible.
We've had an incredible day. Larry, I know we should have been recording the whole day, but we're seeing things. Your father was an amazing man. Amazing. I mean, you talked about how the love that he gets, and we just watched a movie with him. When you see this movie, and it was narrated by Tom Brokaw, it's called Boys in the Hall. What's the first thing you feel when you see him up on the screen like that?
Proud. Actually, very hard for me to watch some of these things with people around me because I do get misty-eyed. And for a 73-year-old guy to get misty-eyed, but it's very heartwarming. And it brings back a lot of memories. I'm old enough to remember the 50s times with Mantle and Maris and Scourin and Ford and the whole rest of the group that I called my uncles. And then we moved into the 60s and the 70s, so I bridged a big gap. So there's a lot of memories in there, and just realize that all these people still have this love for my father is just amazing.
Your father was born in St. Louis on a section called The Hill. His next-door neighbor, a neighbor across the street, was Joe Garagiola. Long-time friends for 90 years, as you said. Yes. He knew him every day of his life, basically.
Yes.
How did that relationship develop over time and as they played on different teams?
It was just as childhood friends would always grow up. Like you would hope that you would maintain a friendship, and this friendship just kept going and going and going. And I remember when my father was about ready to pass, we called Joe on the phone, and when he got on the phone with Joe, it was like my father was reborn. He spoke to the man for like a half an hour. It was like nothing was wrong with him. When they hung up the phone, 20 minutes later, he was back in a stupor. And he passed away a couple of days later. And we called Joe back up on the phone and told him what happened. And he broke down. I said, it's okay. He was in a bed. He says, no, you don't understand. How many people you know knew a man for 90 years? We knew each other for 90 years. We did everything together for 90 years. And I went, well, I'm in the same thing as you. I've known you my whole life, and it was just your friendship was a great thing. And unfortunately, I think it was like 5 or 6 months later, Joe passed away.
You know, you walk in the museum, you see the house where your father was born and where you were born, and I mean, I can't. I was reading everything. And now I'm going to skip ahead, though, because I want to ask you. The thing that popped into my head was, as I'm watching that movie, is what a mistake Branch Rickey made. Now, you set the record straight. I was never sure if it was intentional. Branch Rickey did not sign your father because he was going to the Dodgers, and he thought he would be sly, and he wouldn't sign him until he got to the Dodgers, and that was a mistake. So, set the record straight.
Well, the Joe and Dad had gone to a St. Louis Cardinal tryout, and they both did the tryout. And after the tryout, Branch Rickey offered Joe Garagiola $500, and he offered my father $250. And my father said no. He goes, "I want the same thing as Joe." And Branch Rickey said, "No, it's not worth the risk." He says, "You don't look like a ball player. I don't think you'll ever be a ball player." And so that's the way they parted. And but during the summertime, I mean, Joe signed, but during the summertime, Dad's Legion coach knew a Yankee scout and said, "You got to come and see this guy Larry Berra play." So he came and he convinced the Yankees to give him the $500. And Dad signed with them to become a Yankee. And in the winter before this first spring training or where he was supposed to go, he got a letter, a telegram from Branch Rickey saying, we want you to report to Bear Mountain because now he was with the Dodgers. And my father told him, it's too late. I'm with the Yankees now. So they always say that who knows what would have happened if Dad, even Dad, with Roy Campanella, with Dad and Roy Campanella, Dad could play the outfield. It didn't matter. Where as long as Dad could swing a bat, he didn't really matter to him. He just wanted to play the game of baseball. And the old adage is that Stan Musial was a very close friend of Dad's and said, can you imagine if Branch Rickey had signed you with the Cardinals? He says, you and me in the same lineup, we might have won 10 or 15 more World Series and the Yankees wouldn't have made it.
And if he had signed with the Dodgers, can you imagine that? That would have been the dynasty.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What a team that would have been.
Yes.
Right.
So your dad gets to the Yankees, and he's an unrefined catcher.
Right.
And he takes tutelage from Bill Dickey, another great Yankee. Tell us the relationship and how Bill taught your dad how to catch.
Bill was there the whole time, but Casey was the one that actually brought Bill Dickey back and said, you got to teach this guy how to catch because I don't have any other place to put him. And Dickey took him under his tutelage and taught him how to block balls, how to move his feet, how to make it. Because Dad was, believe it or not, was very quick. He was faster than a lot of people thought. You know, when you look at him, you know, they didn't think he was, you know, here's this guy 5'7", 5'8", had any strength, yet he's probably one of the strongest men I ever met. He's very unhanded, very quick, and Dickie saw it and taught him how to use it. And like in the movie that we did see, Bill Dickey worked the heck out of him, even after hours. They kept him out even later and later. But the one thing makes a difference, Dad wanted to do it. I mean, you know, you can get guys, I don't know, today or whether, you know, oh, I'm tired, I'm done. But my dad just kept going and always wanted to improve himself.
Yeah, your dad did not want to be bored. Yeah. So your dad was a war hero. Mm-hmm. And the assignment that he had during D-Day was a secret assignment. He volunteered for it because he wanted something, right? He wanted to be busy.
Yeah. Well, you talk about him being bored. When he was in the Navy, he didn't, you know, on the ship, so he volunteered for the rocket boats and ended up 300 yards offshore shooting 50 caliber machine guns. But, and the same thing when he played baseball, I told you the story that when he batted, I asked him, how come you don't hit as well with nobody on base? And he goes, that's boring. He says, I want to drive in runs. And I said, well, how do you think he would have hit if you thought about it a little better? He goes, who knows? I might have hit better, but my thing was runs. He said, if you needed a run at a right time, you could put me up there.
Those guys didn't care about their stats. They just cared about winning.
Yeah, they wanted to win. Well, the World Series was the big thing because, you know, the Yankees, it was like triple their salary most of the time. Yeah. And if you're making $3,000 and you get a $7,500 World Series check, now they don't have to work in the wintertime. They can, you know, a lot of guys did anyway, but at least they had some extra money. And if you win the World Series in the towns where you live, you end up doing, you know, like Elks clubs and Lions clubs back in the day when they had all the banquets. And you would go do it and they'd give you $50 cash. You know, $50 is a lot of money for one night just to say hello. Right. And so that's what they would do.
You know, Len mentioned D-Day, and I know I asked you this when we walked in, but could you tell us a story about your dad and Bob Feller, how they became friends?
They became friends mutually just through baseball, but when the first encounter of my father with Bob Feller was that Bob Feller ignored him because he said Dad was too young and should have been fighting. And in the war, and Dad went in and told it was either Vic Rashi or Allie Reynolds or one of them, and they went out and told Bob Feller, "Hey, be better, be nicer to Larry. He was at D-Day," and Bobby didn't know that. And then from then on, they were just really close friends. And a lot of people don't know my father was also at the invasion of Southern France.
Oh.
He was in Southern France too, so he's actually in two invasions.
Wow!
And he has a Purple Heart. Well, he got shot in the hand, which, yep. You know, when you if it had been, you know, a worse injury, then we're not talking about Yogi Berra, the baseball player.
And the thing with the Purple Heart is he never received it because he refused to sign the papers because he didn't want his mother to worry about him. And we've been trying, maybe for the last 15 years. The problem is all of Dad's records, according to the Navy, were destroyed in a St. Louis fire. They had their document center was burned to the ground in St. Louis. And like 2 million soldiers' records were wiped out. So they have no record of it. And the funny thing was the Navy Department sent my daughter a letter saying that if you could find an eyewitness to the situation, we'll consider it. And we said, an eyewitness, only 75 years, who's alive that's on the boat? we said, I don't look like we're going to get it, but in our hearts we know that my father would never lie about it. So.
Of course. Yeah. So he never actually received a Purple Heart.
Right. He didn't want my grandmother to worry.
Wow. You know, walking around the museum with you, I didn't know how close the Yankees were. So they had a really special relationship in that time period. Tell us what you know about it and your dad's special relationship with Joe DiMaggio and Casey Stengel and all those guys.
They were, like I said, they were like you said, they were just one big happy family. I mean, I considered them all my uncles. My godfather was Phil Rizzuto. My brother's is Eddie Lopat. So we're in there all the time. We lived around the corner from Gil McDougal. We used to see Phil Rizzuto with the bowling alley. So these kids, us, we were always together. And in spring training, in the early spring trainings, all the families were together. And then when we moved to Montclair in '59, we had a big yard. And in the back on Saturdays, they used to play Saturday day games and Sunday doubleheaders. After the Saturday, we'd have like barbecues, and you could, if you were lucky, every now and then you'd see Mickey Mantle punting a football at those kids on the front lawn, where you would, you'd see Roger Maris throwing a football, whatever. You'd see any number of players would be at the house, and we were always together. And even at the ballpark, they used to let all us kids. We used to be allowed to go in the clubhouse. And now they don't really, they frown on it, but we used to be in the clubhouse all the time. We would cause trouble. We would cause, because they would cause it. Frank Rossetti was the ball in charge of all the balls, and they'd tell us, go in the ball cage, throw all the balls out into the clubhouse. Uh-huh. And he would get mad. And then Casey, growing up with Casey, Casey loved kids. Him and his wife couldn't have kids. But he loved us kids. We would run into his office when we would get people mad at us, players, and he would yell at the players, you need an appointment to come in this office. These kids are allowed in here. You stay out. So he would protect us.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was great times.
I did want to ask you, your father had a record that we didn't know about until you told us, how he caught 180 shutouts.
Right.
That will never be broken.
No, not today. I mean, it's tough to get a guy to even throw 9 innings. These were complete game shutouts. Supposedly, according to the Yankees and the pitching staff, had all those pitches, maybe 3 pitches were shook off. They never shook them off. Mm-hmm. He used to tell me, I used to say, when you brought a new pitcher to the team, and what did you do with him? Did you meet with him? Did you go over all this stuff? And he said, they would come and try and tell me this is what they would do. And my father would go, wait a minute. He says, first we'll try it my way. He goes, I've done pretty good so far. If it doesn't work, we'll change. So,
and one more thing before I give it over back to Len. He caught every day and doubleheaders. It's something that is unheard of today.
Yes. I think he caught 117 doubleheaders, both games in a day. And then we catch the next day. Usually Mondays were off, though. That was a travel day. But if there was a doubleheader during the week, he would catch the next day. He didn't miss too many games in the 10 years of, from 49 to 58 or somewhere around there. He did a lot of the catching. And then Ellie came over and took over.
You know, we said that the love that Yogi Berra received and gave and all that. But when he first started his career, he was... I don't say the victim of, but he received a lot of abuse. It wasn't easy for him when he first came up, you know. And now we look at it and it's lovable Yogi. But in the beginning, it wasn't. Did he talk about that?
Not really, because that wasn't in his mannerisms. He would just he would take it and he go, "I'll prove to him that I can play." I mean, because I didn't. We have a movie coming out in May, and it'll show the parts. There were things in there I had no idea that even the New York papers had things that, like, the Yankees sign an ape. He's a, you know, they have a gorilla, and I'm going, "Wow, I didn't realize that they, you know, even the sports writers were getting on him." And the players would tease him a little bit of this and that. And he says, and, you know, that's where he gets these things. I don't hit the ball with my face. I can't hit and think at the same time. But I'll go out and I'll prove to them that I know what I'm doing. And he went and did it. And I think a big key in 49 or 48, he met my mother. And I think my mother was, an amazing influence on my father because, I mean, they were married for 65 years. And you talk about a love affair that's ridiculous, and she stuck behind him the whole way. So there was nothing, you know. He did everything for the game, his family, and a country club. That's all he cared about. He didn't care about millions of dollars. He just wanted to take care of his family, have a nice home that belonged to a country club. He couldn't wait to play golf.
He showed us the ring collection from all the rings from the Yankees. But there was one that he wore. Could you tell us the special significance on that one?
That was the 1953 special ring that they gave the 13 players that played on all five world championships, the only team to ever win five in a row, which I could make a bet now. I don't think anybody's going to do it now. But it was a special ring given to 13 players, and he wore that one, and he wore his Hall of Fame ring on the other finger. Never wore it. He lost his wedding ring playing golf when he gave the first month he was married. And he never replaced it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know, you talk about Casey Stengel, and, you know, Casey Stengel is famous for the quote where when they ask him, you know, when you're starting a baseball team, you know, who would you start with? And he says, the catcher, because otherwise I'm going to have a lot of pass balls. And he had Yogi his whole career as the Yankee manager. And I can understand why he would say something like that, because without Yogi Berra, Casey Stengel is not, we're not, you don't talk about Casey Stengel with the same reverence either.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was nice to know when we spoke to Casey, and as I got older, I got to talk to him more. I would sit on the buses with him when we traveled, and he would talk to me. I actually, in 65, when my father first went to the Mets and Casey was managing, they had Warren Spahn also. And Greg Spahn and myself, we were the same age. Like I guess we were like 15 or something, 16 at the time. And we bat boyed one game in spring training. And the Met pitchers, there were two of them, I think, Gordon Richardson and I can't remember the name of the other one. They pitched a no-hitter against Pittsburgh, I think it was. And we were coming out, you know, the team's coming out, and they asked, they're screaming at Casey, "How about your pitcher?" He goes, "My two bat boys brought us the no-hitter." And I'm going, "That's terrific." He didn't mention our name, but he says, "I got two bat boys here." That was terrific. But his knowing or seeing something in Dad might not have been seen by another manager. But he was the one that told Dickie, "You got to teach this guy how to catch." And he saw something and he went with it. And, you know, we know what happened.
Warren Spahn had a great quote. When he played for Casey Stengel, he played from before he was a genius and after he was a genius. That's a great line.
It's a lot of fun, though. I got to know Warren pretty well, too, especially going up to the Hall of Fame every year until they own now. All the guys that I had a great time with are all passing. So,
right. Yeah. About the Hall of Fame, I was shocked to learn that your dad wasn't the first on the first ballot. He was, yeah, I think, the second ballot, third ballot.
Second ballot, but I don't think Joe DiMaggio was in on the first ballot either. But back then, nobody, I think, got in on the first ballot. That was very, very rare. Now it's like, let him in. But that's another story. I mean, you know, sports writers have changed. Everything has changed. You know, this thing was that nobody gets into the Hall of Fame first. And in my opinion, and just reading, never saw the man play, but the only guy that should be in the Hall of Fame on one ballot is Babe Ruth. I don't care what anybody tells me about who's playing today, tomorrow, next week, or whatever. Babe Ruth has got to be on the pinnacle. You know, people talk about this guy doing this and that. People forget this guy was an amazing pitcher, had an ERA titles, and then hit 344 lifetime. Mm-hmm. There's nobody hitting 344 lifetime anymore.
No.
So,
and Larry, we talked about the growing up and how there were people that you associated with, that you met, that you know, that were players. You said you met Abbott and Costello, and just tell our listeners what it was like to meet some of these people. And you know what? Better yet, what it was like, but also who was somebody that you met that just like even you were just super impressed that you were meeting this person.
Boy, that's if I had known, I mentioned some, but we used to go to Madison Square Garden all the time. And we used to go to all the Knick games. We went to the Ranger games. We'd go see fights. And we would either go to Toot Shores before or after. And that was a mecca of celebrities. And we would go, my brother and I would go, and we'd sit there, and we'd end up, we'd find out later, you know, when as we got older, we were eating dinner with Frank Gifford, Phil Silvers, Jackie Gleason, all these famous people. And I'm going to my father. I said, nobody just figured they could take a picture, because my parents never took photos. They weren't big. They would meet people, and my father would, it was, you know, he's a person. You know, it was filled, you know, he would say, okay, you know, but they never really, you know, hit him. He like, you can meet the garbage man, and you can meet Phil Silvers or somebody, and it would be they're equal. You know, and but I did meet, you know, I was told the one shocker that I had about meeting a person was my mother told me that I sat on the lap of Marilyn Monroe. Wow. And I was like, are you kidding me? And you didn't, but you're only 2.5, 3 years old, and you didn't take a picture? And I'm going, oh boy, terrible.
If they had camera phones back then, maybe.
Oh man. But but it's been like that, you know, all the time. Another thrill was when I was in the minor leagues. I was playing in Pompano, and we were having an opening night, and Jackie Gleason was throwing out the first pitch. This is when he used to have his golf tournament down in Fort Lauderdale, Miami area. He's there, and I'm there, and all of a sudden I hear this thing over the thing. He goes, "Which one of you guys is Berra?" And I went up to him, and I go, "Oh, Mr. Gleason, I don't know if you're there." He goes, I met you in Toot Shores and everything. And he goes, where's your fat old man? He was supposed to be in my golf tournament. He didn't come down this year. What happened? I said, I don't know. What are you asking me for? But he singled me out. I thought that was pretty cool, too.
Yeah. Well, you said also that your parents were not, they didn't take the pictures, they didn't save things. In this museum, which I encourage everybody to come to, I mean, this is just unbelievable. There is a picture done by Leroy Neiman of your dad. It's incredible, but you said that this picture was almost thrown out.
Almost in the garbage. Yep, it was in a pile. My parents were moving from one house to another, and I went up to the house, and I went upstairs to see my dad. He had his trophy room upstairs, and in the middle of the room was a giant pile of stuff. And I was just looking through stuff. I was picking stuff out. I said, well, I'm going to take some of this. So I took some, and then I pull up this tube. I unroll it, and I look at it, and I said, Mom, are you sure you want to throw this away? And she goes, why? What is it? And I look. She looks at it, and she goes, well, maybe I better keep it. It was the original charcoal drawing of my father done by Leroy Neiman in spring training, signed by Neiman and Dad. And it's in a lot of his art books and everything else.
And the original's right here at the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Montclair, New Jersey. Larry, you mentioned, and I'm glad you brought this up, you mentioned that you were in the minor leagues. We know that your brother Dale played ball, Tim was in the NFL.
Yeah.
But you were also in the Mets minor league system.
Yes.
And you were telling us some of the guys you caught. And you were a catcher. So tell us, Tom Seaver, Nolan Ryan.
I went to my spring training, and in spring training, all the catchers and all the pitchers go early. So, you know, it was just warming them up and getting them to, I didn't catch them in games or anything like that because they were on the major league club. I was just down in the minor league. The only guy I played in an inter-squad game was John Matlack. But, yeah, just catching them, you know, you learn that when you come, I don't care if you're in college or whatever, you learn you're at another bracket when you're catching a Seaver or a Tug McGraw or somebody like that. It's another step up, and you can see why there's only so many players and so many fall by the wayside. But it was a big thrill for me. I got to do it twice, 2 years, and that was it. And then I got hurt and bad, and I had a bad knee injury that couldn't be fixed by that year, that time's technology. Mm-hmm. And they told me we could maybe do it for 2 or 3 days. You could play 2 or 3 days a week. I said, hey, that's not going to do me any good. And unfortunately, I had a surgery in high school too. And that was the start. It didn't help me to have surgery at high school too.
Right. You know, you also told us when your dad managed the Mets that Mrs. Payson had a special relationship with your dad. Could you tell us about Mrs. Payson?
Mrs. Payson had a special relationship with everybody. She was just a great owner. I mean, she was friendly. I mean, I think everybody, I don't remember anybody not liking Mrs. Payson, even the wives. She was always around with the wives and talking, always involved. And I don't think anybody was upset to... You know, she had a guy, M. Donald Grant, which was a little tougher. So I don't think too many, you know, he was as well liked as Mrs. Payson. But my mother and father loved being with the Mets. Great. Yeah, they had a great relationship.
You know, Larry, you talk about you were in the Mets minor league system. And you have, Yogi Berra, perhaps, in my opinion, greatest catcher ever, okay? I know people will say they may bring up Johnny Bench or what.
It's
an elite group. I mean, as long as you put them all together, you know, okay. You can't say one above the other.
Okay.
Different eras, different everything else.
All right, no problem. But did you ever have, and I get the feeling you never got it from your father, but did you ever have, as you were moving up in the system and in the minor leagues, did you ever have where you had people saying, we want you to be like your father, or, yeah. You know, what, well, how was it like that?
That's all the time. I had one, not, I can't say bad experience, just one altercation with it. I was in Wytheville, Virginia, which doesn't have a team anymore, but we were playing, I'm in the on-deck circle, and there's this guy behind us going, you're not as good as your father, you're not as good as this. You're not as good as that. And I turned around and I said to him, if I was as good as my father, I wouldn't be in this bleeping town listening to your ass. And Chuck Hiller, who was my manager, came up and grabbed me and he goes, you can't talk like that. You can't talk like that to the fans. I said, okay, but it just got on my nerves. But that's about the only time. And then when I was playing high school ball, you would get some, and I just said, I just did what my father used to say, just show them you can play the game. And they began, most of the guys that I played against are my friends. You know, they're my friends.
Your dad, post-playing career, had a great commercial career. We saw a bunch of the commercials and the light beer one and the Affleck one, and they're just so terrific. He was quite the businessman, and he also was a vice president of Yahoo, wasn't he?
But that was all. That was a made position. He didn't really do much. He was just their PR. And when I was a kid, I know that when Yahoo was first out, he used to go to all the supermarkets and do signings, and I would go with him. And we would go to the supermarkets, and he would do the signings. And then some of them, we go to the game, a night game. We go to the game afterwards. That's pretty fun because they used to do two guys from Harrison, was a department store out here. They used to do those, and I used to go at 10, 11 years old. One of my favorite things is I bought a model airplane. While he was signing, I brought it to the ballpark, and Mickey Mantle helped me build an Avro Lancaster, a British bomber. And I look at this, it's cool. I can remember. So I thought that was pretty funny.
One of the commercials was, and Jeff pointed this out, was the beer commercial, and your dad's there, and standing to the right of him in the back is a young Jason Alexander of Seinfeld, from Seinfeld.
Yeah.
That was very cool. That was amazing.
That is one of my the Miller commercial and the Affleck commercial are two of my favorite commercials that he ever made. He made a lot of them, but those were the two best ones.
They give you cash, which is just as good as money.
You know what was great is he went with it. He said, if I'm going to be known for this, I'm going to make a career from it. And he did. And all the power to him. It's phenomenal.
And he did a couple of years. He wasn't extravagant, but he did enough to be in the Screen Actors Guild. He was in the Screen Actors Guild, and he did a couple of the shows. You know, he was on the Phil Silver show. And played a Southern gentleman to get Dick Van Dyke to sign with the Yankees. Phil Silvers was trying to get him to sign with the Yankees. But that's when he had Whitey. I think Whitey Gilmacdougal was there. Dan Topping was in it, and it was a lot of fun.
Wasn't he a brain surgeon in General Hospital?
Yeah, that's because of Johnny Berardino, the actor that played the famous doctor. He was on the St. Louis Browns. And they knew each other from baseball, and John asked them to do the show. So I think he was on one or two appearances or something on this show. Yeah, he played a famous brain surgeon. I said, well, that's a brilliant part for you.
Before we let you go, we're at this great museum, and this is where George Steinbrenner came to apologize to your dad. You were there that day.
Yes.
So tell us, take us through what was happening.
No, it was packed. And George was late, so originally they all thought he's not going to show up. But Susan Wallman was doing the show here, and George finally came in. And the first thing my father said to him, "You're late." And George goes, "Hey, you're screaming. I flew all the way up here from Florida. You told me I'm late." But they went into a room. And my mother went in for about, I think it was like, what was half an hour, 40 minutes or so. They came out, and we went, "It's over." And they became, and that was the end of it. And they were friendly right from the beginning. And like I told you in the museum, that he never really hated George. He just wanted George to personally apologize to him for not keeping his promise.
Yeah, you said that he did not like to be lied to. I mean, nobody does. Yeah. But and that is what really he hated, or that bothered him. Mm. But and you also mentioned how in all the years that you had your father in your life, you never heard a single bad word about him from anyone.
Yeah. It's amazing that. And we tried to tell my father, I said, the effect that you have on people, just by you waving or saying hi, it gives somebody a joy. It was just incredible. We could never figure it out. It was just something in him, the way he was. And like I said, I mean, you could, when we were kids, you could get up in the morning, and you go downstairs, and in the kitchen, he'd have a fireman, a policeman, a garbage man, the milkman, all at the table having coffee with him. And it just, there was nothing, as long as you were a good person, didn't lie, you were in his realm of friendship.
And he is one of those rare people, the one word, the one name. He doesn't need to, you don't need to say, all you say is Yogi.
Yep.
And people know who you're talking about. And his name evokes a smile. I know when we came in here today, I mean, I'm going to be fanboy now and just say how much I could not wait to have you take us through this museum, to get to see everything. And it's just, Yogi Berra is always one of my favorite players. Mm-hmm. We talked about how this museum just, it just makes people smile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things we try to do at the museum, too, is like you were saying, Yogi. And we're trying to get the younger people to realize that Yogi is not Yogi Bear. It's Yogi Berra.
Mm.
Because a lot of it's waned a little bit because of his sayings. He's known more now for his sayings than anything else. And we're trying to bring back the fact that he was one heck of a ball player. I mean, it's very hard to, win three MVPs and play in 10 World Series. And nobody's going to win 10 World Series again as a player. It's not going to happen. So,
I just thought of this, and I wanted to bring it up. You're talking about what a great, you know, all the great things. He's on a postage stamp.
Right.
Okay. I heard a funny story. I heard you interviewed on another show, and when you were a kid, I guess you collected stamps.
I collected stamps.
And you wanted him to be on a stamp, and then yeah, you found out. Well, tell us about
I collect stamps, and I still do a little bit now. Not as much as I used to, but when I was a kid, I said, boy, I'd love to have my father on a postage stamp. And the guy that I used to talk to a lot about it says, you don't want him on a stamp yet. And I go, why? And he goes, he's got to be dead. And I said, well, maybe you're right. I said, don't put him on yet then.
Well, but he did, you know, yeah. Unfortunately, I mean... He passed away at 90, and he did get on a stamp. Yeah. That is not something that everyone gets honored with. So yeah. What was that like?
No, that was great. But I think one of my greatest things that I got to do was I received his Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama. Yeah. And being in the White House, and, you know, I know how people... you know, you could like a president, you can't like a president, you can do this or something. I said, but I'm in the White House, and my father is getting honored by the United States, by the President of the United States. And I said, I don't care who the president is. I'm going to accept this award. I said, this is amazing. And just being in that building with all the other dignitaries that were there was incredible. But that's one of my big, and then, you know, I've had some great things, the Hall of Fame, his induction in the Hall of Fame, getting to accept his number. They retired his number in Yankee Stadium, and my mother asked me to receive the number on the field. I got to do that. And so it's been pretty cool.
Thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. This museum is a great legacy to your dad, and I encourage, like Len said, everybody should come out here because it is just a fantastic, and it's just not a museum, it's also a learning center. So, yeah. You know, come enjoy the day. It is just fantastic.
Yeah, and I appreciate you coming out. I know it took us a little time to get together, but we did it, and it's anytime well worth you it. Want to come again, let me know. I love doing this kind of stuff.
We are so appreciative. Let me just say that when Baseball and Barbecue gets to episode number 888, because we've already passed 8, we've passed 88, but when we get to 888, it will be dedicated to Yogi Berra.
Oh, wow.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry Berra. The stories that he told, the life that he lived, unbelievable. Can you imagine that? Casey Stengel.
I know, right?
Have cookouts. Roger Maris is in your backyard.
What? Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's unbelievable.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I hear it again, and I'm like, I just can't. It's unbelievable. Now, Jeff, we as the interview was playing, since we've heard it, we looked up as far as what we were talking about with the players getting paid for these in-game interviews, and you and I found the same thing: $10,000. They get paid.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is, and I'm quoting from the article written by Matt Musico. And
right.
Elite Sports NY, which he says he credits Andrew Marchand of New York Post. ESPN started making these interviews a weekly occurrence last season. According to Marchand, players are paid $10,000 to chat with the broadcast booth during the game. This is what I understand. This money comes from funds shared between MLB and the Players Association. What? I don't understand that.
They have a dual account.
They're encouraging them to go in and do this.
I know. ESPN. I mean, if shared funds between MLB and the Players Association, so ESPN doesn't even pay for that?
No, according to this.
They apparently feel that. I don't know. They think it adds to the game, obviously, but...
Well, I'm so thrilled to know that Brandon Nimmo wants Kevin Costner to play him in a movie. That's just really great journalism there.
Jeff, you know who I think should play you in a movie?
Who's that?
Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt?
Yeah. And it's unfortunate Of course, he has passed away. But I think that all of a sudden, I can't think of his name. David Spade and...
Chris Farley.
Chris Farley. I think Chris Farley should have played me in a movie. Okay. That would have been a good movie.
Yes.
Baseball and Barbecue Podcast, the movie. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts, but we're not starting. We are ending. And just before we end, let's just thank once again our great guests, our Hall of Fame guests, Meathead, Doug Scheiding, and Larry Behra. And now we leave you on episode 183 with a great song from the musician Shel Kurkovsky, the poet Dave Dresser. I got it wrong. It's the poet Shel Kurkovsky, the musician Dave Dresser, but the song is the same. Beautiful song. It's called Baseball Always Brings You Home, and it certainly does.
Yeah.
Best.